This is James Corbett of the Corbett Report. It's the 17th of June 2009 here in Japan, but it's still the 16th of June in California, where I'm joined on the line once again by Dan Hamburg. Dan Hamburg served as a Democratic congressman in California's 1st District from 1993 to 1995. He is currently the executive director of Voice of the Environment, a 501c3 Montana-based environmental organization devoted to exposing the real environmental catastrophes threatening our planet, from vaccines to GMOs to dwindling old-growth forests. Mr. Hamburg, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Well, Mr. Hamburg, last time you were on, we talked about your work exposing the preparations for martial law under continuity of government planning that has been going on for decades. But today I'd like to shift gears and talk about your work with Voice of the Environment. Why don't you tell us about this organization and how you came to be involved with it?
Well, the organization actually began in the early 1990s, I think 1991. And it was formed by a man named Lewis Seiler, who actually still owns a 1,000-acre ranch in Montana. And as he saw what was going on around his neighborhood, which was the Bitterroot Valley, with respect to logging in the national forests, and he saw what plans were being developed by the federal government to expand road building and logging and activities associated with logging in the national forests, particularly of Montana and Idaho, under the auspices of still Senator Max Baucus and at that time Larry Craig, the senator from Idaho. When he saw that the effects that were going to be brought on these national forests by the pressures being brought to bear by the timber industry and their allied extractive industries, which is mining and logging, all the activities that have to do with removing resources from the landscape and from the ground. When he saw that was happening, he decided to form an organization and fight back, and that organization became Voice of the Environment. And for the next many years, actually I'd say like the next 10 years, most of the battles that were taken on by this organization involved logging and the effects of logging, not only in the national forest, but also in some of the state forests and on some of the corporate land. Although Voice of the Environment was originally formed as a corporation in Montana, it also has offices in the Bay Area near San Francisco and became very involved in some of the fights to save the last of the old-growth forests of Northern California and Southern Oregon. So a lot of work on forest issues, and then branching off into some other areas like GMOs, looking at the food supply and the ways that was being compromised by corporate initiatives, looking at the problems of what is put on our farmland in the form of fertilizer and the issue of the recycling of industrial waste into the fertilizer stream. And then, of course, that fertilizer goes on the farmland and the crops are grown there. And then through the food chain, those chemicals that all of us know are not healthy for human beings end up in our food supply. And so we started to branch out and look at some of these other issues. And I'd say one of the main things that drove us to get involved with these hazardous waste and GMO issues was the deteriorating state of the health of children. And some of the statistics we saw made our eyes pop out, and we said, something has to be done about this. And, there are many groups that work on these issues, but we became one of those and allied ourselves with groups around the country that are fighting for a healthier diet, a more chemical-free diet, and looking at some of the activities of corporate America in making us less safe in many, many different ways.
Well, all of these are extremely important issues, although I think there are issues that people don't often associate with environmentalism per se. And another one of those issues is the vaccines, of course, and the link between vaccines and autism, which has gone into in-depth on the homepage of Voice of the Environment at voiceoftheenvironment.org. Can you talk about some of these issues and how they're not usually taken up by the environmental movement?
Well, it is true that the environmental movement has tended to concentrate more on kind of birds and bees and looking less at the fact that we humans have become guinea pigs in a vast experiment by the chemical industries and the pharmaceutical industries. People are not aware of how laxly regulated. I mean, I think it's because the powers that be in our society are always talking about, oh, regulation is what's dragging our economy down. We need less government. And, you know, we all know where that's led us with respect to the financial system, because that became obvious, you know, when people's 401ks came apart and we had this mortgage crisis and we've got, you know, the bailouts and everything. But what people don't understand is that this deregulatory environment has also led to a very serious compromising of our health. And, of course, the most vulnerable of us are our children. And many of the standards for what is safe for a human being to take into their body in terms of various chemicals are based on adult body weight. And we know that children are much more sensitive to these substances than our adults. So we started looking at specifically at the issue of immunizations, and we learned a word that has now become, you know, fairly common among people who are concerned about vaccinations, and that word is thimerosal. And thimerosal is a preservative. It's a mercury-based preservative that's been in use for 70 years. It was originally developed in the 1930s by Eli Lilly. And Eli Lilly, the LA Times came out with a report a few years ago showing that Eli Lilly knew in the early 90s that this preservative they were using in their doses of vaccine can lead to mild to severe mental retardation, and that thimerosal itself is a hazardous substance that actually requires toxic waste disposal. But because, and this is not just the pharmaceutical industry, but all these extractive industries and the mortgage industry and every major industry in the United States is intimately tied to the federal government. And, I mean, I don't think that's any news to any of your listeners, but like we learned that in 2002 when Congress was looking at putting into place an immunity protection for the pharmaceutical industry, that industry, the pharmaceutical industry, had donated $30 million to the very politicians who were in charge of regulating the industry. Now, you know, one way to look at that is it's chump change. You know, one thing that's amazing about American politics, and this definitely applies to things that affect the environment and affect public health, is how cheap it is, how few millions, relatively, it takes to get provisions written into law that literally make these companies into, billion-dollar industries. It's interesting, for example, that the pharmaceutical industry has the highest profit margin of any other group of industries on the Fortune 500, a 17% median profit margin for the top 10 drug companies, compared to a 3.1% median profit margin for Fortune 500 companies overall. So thimerosal and it's the associated problems of vaccinations that contain mercury and other preservatives has become finally a national issue because some prominent people have taken it up and have, mainly it's because children of some very prominent people have been stricken with autism and the diseases which are associated with autism. They call it the autism spectrum disorder, and this is a whole constellation of illnesses. But when some very prominent people's children came down with this, the issue began to kind of mushroom, and at this point, I think a lot more people know about the problem. But this is in the context of a situation where one in six children, according to the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, one in six children in the United States suffer a neurological disorder. Now, this is not just because of the immunization programs and thimerosal and that, but just looking at it, overall, one in six children in this country suffer some form of neurological disorder. It's just staggering.
It's a horrifying statistic, to be sure. And, of course, you're referring to Jenny McCarthy and Jim Carrey and their Green Our Vaccines movement, which I would suggest my listeners look into. And so what is your involvement or your background with environmental activism, and what campaigns have you been involved with?
Well, I grew up in the I'm kind of a 60s person. And when I went to university in the late 60s, most of the campus politics was around the anti-war movement, and I really did not know much about environmental politics, or it just wasn't really something that was in my consciousness. However, if there was one point at which I kind of changed, it was when I think it was the year I was graduating from Stanford University, and I was on a I was just going from the school over to the beach, which was a trip that I took a lot because the beach was nearby, and I remember going up the highest point on this road called La Honda Road, and I looked down into Silicon Valley. And for the first time, I really saw air pollution. It just something kind of clicked in my head, and I went, wow, this didn't look like this 4 or 5 years ago when I first came here. And, just something in my head went, wow, this doesn't look very healthy. And from there, I moved to Mendocino County, which is a county about the size of Delaware, about a 3,500 square mile area with 80,000 people. So it's mostly forest land, sparsely populated. And the environment of Mendocino County is the economy of Mendocino County. I mean, people always say that the environment really does form the basis for the economy, and it's almost a truism now, but in Mendocino County, it really was true that without the forest products industry, without the fishing industry, and some pears, grapes, apples, agriculture, there really was no economy, and so I got involved with the issues of what the forest products industry was doing to the county, and how it was affecting fishing and the degradation of our streams and the degradation of the water supply. And out of that concern, I got involved in the local politics, became a planning commissioner, and then became a member of the Board of Supervisors. And that's when I really became very taken with the issues of the environment. And I was maybe the first county supervisor in Mendocino County who was an environmentalist, it was still kind of a dirty word in this county. I'm talking about 1980. Environmentalism was something that kept people from doing the things they needed to do to earn a living. And so we were in that whole difficult paradigm of, you know, are you for the environment or are you for jobs? And, you know, that was something that I, as a politician and as a director of an environmental organization, you struggle with, you know, every day is how do you keep people alive and keep them able to put food on the table and pay their mortgage and so on without compromising the environment. And the way we have set up the economy in this country is a disaster for the environment because, you know, as your listeners well know, we are a consumption-based economy, and we tend to think that the environment is, you know, this goes all the way back to our Judeo-Christian roots, that the environment is there for the taking, and it's up to human beings to exploit the environment and turn it into things that are useful for human beings. We have a very difficult time, and I think it's been certainly in my lifetime that this has changed, that people have realized that the environment is not something out there. It is us. We are every much as part of the environment as the trees and the birds and the rocks and the water, and, you know, there is no separation. So that is the kind of consciousness that, you know, that we have to get to as a species, or the time of human beings on this planet is going to be, you know, shortened by a great deal. And, of course, there's already many reputable scientists who believe that this 21st century could be the last century for there to be a large population of human beings on the planet. And, you know, while I think population is, you know, probably does need to be much less than it is today, I think it's more a matter of how we relate to the environment and how we adjust our lifestyles to live in harmony with the environment than it is a matter simply of, well, we have 6 billion people, we need to get it down to, you know, 2 billion people or we can't survive on this planet. But, the current, I think it's pretty clear to a lot of us now that if we keep going in this direction, we're not going to be going in this direction for long, because the famous saying, Mother Nature bats last, is definitely going to catch up with us.
Well, I certainly agree that rather than reducing the population in terms of numbers, we just need to change our lifestyles to become more in line with a self-sufficient lifestyle, not based on the types of lifestyles that we've been told by the corporate-controlled media and the corporations themselves we need to live. But certainly as someone with a long history of environmental activism, I'm sure you've seen over the decades how the green movement, and the environmental movement, which started out as something so anti-corporate, has in fact been, to a large extent, I think, usurped or had its energy sapped by the very corporations themselves, which are seeking to turn the green movement into a type of lifestyle that they can then market to people. What do you think about that that idea of the green movement being usurped by the very corporations which were originally opposed by that movement?
Well, you know, it's sort of the genius of American corporate capitalism, that it manages to swallow everything and turn it into itself. I mean, isn't that what culture does? You know, it eats everything. It consumes everything. It takes in everything. And that's what's happened with Big Green, you know, what I call Big Green, the big environmental groups, which are constantly in search of funds to sustain themselves. And, of course, to get those funds, they turn to where the money is. And, you know, the money is largely with the very wealthy and with large corporations. And So that's part of it. But I think it's more than that too. I think it's a mentality that that we always, you know, that the greater we need to compromise, need to get along, need to figure out a way that we can all work together. But the problem is we're all trying to work together within a system that is basically unsustainable and very heavily corrupted. I mean, even if the system wasn't corrupted, we would still be in a hell of a lot of trouble, because it's a system that, as I said, is basically about exploitation and consumption. And that just is not sustainable. I have a friend, Sylvia Winter, who points out beautifully that capitalism's genius is production. But where it doesn't have a clue is distribution. And I think we're seeing how that plays out today, where one of the greatest problems of capitalism is this huge overcapacity. And in spite of that fact, we keep pushing more and more and more of the money of the society into fewer and fewer hands. I mean, Henry Ford understood that it didn't matter how many Model Ts came off the assembly line. If the guys that built them couldn't afford to buy them and drive them home, the Ford Motor Company was going to go belly up. But that kind of understanding that I think the earlier capitalists had has kind of gone out the window. And now we have a system that is unsustainable because the resources aren't there to sustain it. And also we have a system that is so heavily corrupted, as we were talking about earlier, with the pharmaceutical industry and the mining industry and the timber industry. Everything gravitates. We're seeing it now, in this healthcare debate, where Obama, he wants to move the country along and he wants to help these 50 million people have no health insurance, but he has to do it, or he believes he has to do it, within the parameter of the corporate capitalist system. And the problem with the corporate capitalist system and meaningful social change is that you can't get there from here. You can't assume this system and get to dealing with climate change or deal with campaign finance reform or deal with healthcare reform or deal with, everything is subsumed by the system itself. And until we get underneath that system and root it out and begin to build something new, which I think is happening, but my question is always, is it happening quickly enough? Are the thinkers like, the Wendell Berrys and the James Howard Kunstlers and the visionaries out there who are urging us to lay down our burden and go to something that is better and that is really sustaining of life, not just for ourselves, but hopefully for future generations of human beings. Can we get there fast enough? Can we get there before the climate heats up by 2 degrees centigrade? If you really want to put it into technical terms, are we going to be able to get a handle on this thing? And we're only going to be able to do that if we attack the fundamental ideas of the corporate capitalist mindset. And it's not going to be easy. And it's so discouraging now to see Obama become president with this big surge of hope and optimism and see him following the same model as all his predecessors have followed. And, somebody needs to give Barack Obama a good chance. We can't get there from here.
Well, certainly I think it must be disheartening for Obama's supporters to see him selling out to corporate interests, but probably shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone who realizes that the office of the presidency is beholden to the corporate interests that put them into power. And certainly Obama's campaign was greatly helped by the corporate media, which certainly helped his campaign come along. Well, since you bring up the idea of climate change, I think if you've listened to my previous podcasts on that episode, you'll know that my personal position is that climate change is one of the monstrosity creations of the big green industry, as you term it. I think that the science shows that, in fact, climate change is part of natural variations, and this is something that's being exploited by Big Green in order to ultimately make money for certain individuals. I noticed that climate change is, in fact, not one of the issues that's featured on Voice of the Environment's website. Why is that?
Well, because it's an issue that is being addressed by other organizations. It's we got involved in, for example, the issue of GMOs, the genetically modified organisms. We got involved in that because I reside in Mendocino County. Mendocino County was the first county in the United States to put an initiative on the ballot to outlaw genetically modified organisms. So I just decided that I would devote my efforts and the efforts of Voice of the Environment for a period of time into trying to get that ordinance passed, hoping that that would become a model for other cities and counties throughout the country. And we were able to do that. We were able to become the first. And I know there are some counties who have followed us, but it was a fascinating campaign because Monsanto and the other companies who were involved in producing GMOs looked on this campaign as a serious threat to their power to shape public opinion on this issue. And they spent about $750,000, and as I said, this is a county of only about 80,000 people, and so we had a lot on our hands. I mean, we had pretty much the whole industry focused on stopping this initiative, and yet it passed with almost 60% of the vote, and it really showed, I think, that there are areas in the country, and I think, Mendocino County, and I'd say, looking at it a little larger area, the entire north coast of California is one of those areas where people are tremendously concerned about these issues of what's in their food and making sure that that we don't allow companies like Monsanto and their brethren to take over the food production of our society. And so we decided to take on that issue, and we were successful, and several other counties followed in our footsteps. And it was something we could do as a small environmental organization without taking on really more than we could handle. Similarly, when we took on the immunization issue, when we took on the issue of hazardous chemicals and fertilizers, and these were all issues that there was a real vacuum. There were no other organizations who were taking on these problems, and so we decided this was something that we could make a contribution toward.
Well, that's personally what's attracted me so much to Voice of the Environment, is that it dwells on the issues that I think a lot of the other environmental groups don't touch on. And these are very important and very fundamental issues, from toxins in the vaccines to GMOs to the threatening of old-growth forests, extremely important issues that really do affect our ecosystem, our environment, and ourselves, our own personal health. So that's something that I think is extremely important about this organization, and why I encourage my listeners to check out Voice of the Environment at voiceoftheenvironment.org. But I guess in closing, then, if corporate interests are turning the green lifestyle and outlook into little more than a fashion trend that they can market like any other, how then do people who are genuinely concerned about these fundamental issues about the environment turn that movement back into something where people actually are able to affect and impact the environment and the area in which they're living?
Well, I think that's one of the most encouraging things that's happening right now is that people are beginning to look at what can be done within their own little bioregion or even within their own watershed. That's certainly happening here in Mendocino County with our slow food movement and our movements to encourage people to put in their own gardens. And it's interesting, we were expanding our little flock of chickens recently. We had to wait 6 weeks to get chicks in at the local feed store because so many people in this area are now raising their own chickens. And the same thing with vegetable starts. And people are starting to understand, and you can look at Michelle Obama's thing at the White House and say, well, that's kind of just a symbolic thing. But I really believe that people as individuals, as families, and as communities really need to look at how they're going to remain alive and healthy in an environment in which so much of what we've accepted as our structure, as society, is falling apart. I mean, I don't think that the federal government of the United States is any longer viable. And I think what we have is hundreds of thousands and soon millions of people saying, we need to figure these things out for ourselves. We need to figure out how to feed ourselves. We need to figure out how to house ourselves, how to protect ourselves. Because these systems are not functioning well any longer. I don't know if I'm on the board of an environmental organization called Forest Forever. It's a voluntary position as a board member, and we're doing we're not a huge organization by any means, but what we found was that the larger environmental organizations in California, like the Planning and Conservation League and the Sierra Club, some of those groups had totally pulled out of trying to influence forestry legislation in the state. And we decided that as a small organization, we needed to step up and fill that vacuum. So we're doing that. But I think it was interesting to me that as I approached legislators in Sacramento, what I heard, especially from ones who cared about the environment, was that the Sierra Club was no longer a meaningful agent of environmental change in the state. And I think that gets back to what you were saying about how much they become corporate controlled. And I think it's these smaller organizations. And, I know of many of them, and I communicate with them on a daily basis. I think it's the smaller organizations that in most cases are the ones who are really solution-oriented and less top-heavy and just in general more progressive in their outlook about where we need to go.
Well, absolutely. Just as self-sufficiency is the key at the individual level, being able to grow your own food and to make your own way in the world, I think self-sufficiency is also key at an organizational level where a small group of people can actually interact and act together to try to make change rather than an organization which itself becomes sort of a monstrosity which has to be wielded. So again, small organizations like Voice of the Environment are important, and I really do encourage my listeners to check out some small organizations perhaps in their local areas. But in closing, how can people find out more about Voice of the Environment and about your work?
Well, they can certainly go to the website, and on the website they'll see my email address, and they're certainly welcome to get in touch with me in that way. And if there's any areas in which we have expertise, I think we're very adept at networking people with you know, with others of like mind. I'm in contact with people throughout the country who are working on the issues that we're working on and many other issues. So, I just encourage people to go to our website and feel free to contact me. And also I want to say that I really appreciate what the Corbett Report does, too. I was actually turned on to you by somebody who works as an advisor to our organization who had listened to some of your podcasts. And, here you are, a guy in somewhere in rural Japan, and you're, contributing to the debate in a very meaningful way over here in the United States. And so, I want to thank you, too, for the great work you do. And I have a lot of fun listening to you as I travel around in my car and put your CDs in my player, and it's very stimulating stuff.
Well, that's extremely exciting to hear, and I'm absolutely flattered, and I'm just doing what I can to help contribute to the debate, so I'm glad that it's getting out there. Well, Mr. Hamburg, I'd like to thank you once again for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with me today on the Corbett Report, and wish you the best of luck in all of your future work.
It's my pleasure.